How are y'all? Woo! Okay, all right, a little bit of a reception there. I'll take it. Thank you. Man, my name's Carter. I'm one of the pastors here at Redemption Church, and I just want to say a special welcome to you, especially if you're new. But whether you're joining us here in person or whether you're joining us online, I'm glad that you're with us today. And I'm glad to be back myself, you know, because my family was on vacation for a few weeks, and I haven't preached in three, so I'm ready to jump right back into it. So buckle up, okay? I've just been boiling over for the last 3 weeks. I can't stand it, so I'm glad to be back into it. And man, I thought our three speakers for the last 3 weeks were great. Can we give them a round of applause to thank them for being here and doing that for us? If you missed some of them, you ought to go back and listen and check them out. But they were great, very encouraging stuff. And we've been in Matthew in our series, Who is Jesus, this summer. So we've got a few weeks left of this. And we're not so much detailing theological points about who Jesus is, as much as we're trying to understand who he is through his actions, as Matthew, one of his disciples, writes them down and records them for us in his gospel, right? We want to try to understand who Jesus is through what he does. And so we've been reading through this part of Matthew to try to foster a sense of deep, dependent worship on him. That's what our theme is for the year as a church, is deep, dependent worship. The only way we can do that is if we know who Jesus is, right? And so that's what we're doing here through this series. We've got a few weeks left in it until we get into the next series, which is called Grow, The Secret to Spiritual Maturity. I'm really excited about that. That's going to be kicking off at our fall launch, so I hope you'll be here for that. It's going to be really good for us, helpful in ways to understand what it looks like to mature in our faith and to grow in spiritual maturity. But now let's get into Matthew for today. We're going to be in Matthew chapter 11, starting in verse 25, if you want to turn there or find it on your device. And I want to ask you this to get your mind thinking about what we're talking about today. Have you ever felt anxious before? You don't have to raise your hand, because I know we all have felt anxious at some point, right? Have you ever felt overwhelmed by anything? Have you ever been so fearful that you just can't think about anything else but that thing that you're afraid of? Have you ever been so angry or frustrated that you just can't get it out of your mind? It just keeps coming up over and over. You're seething with bitterness and frustration. Have you ever felt any of those kinds of emotions that just grip you so much that it's almost like they consume you, right? You can't get past them. Well, you know, these emotions actually aren't bad in and of themselves, because they do indicate something that's going on in our heart that we need to pay attention to and be able to deal with. But man, in the moment that we're feeling those kinds of emotions, it gets really difficult, right? I mean, they just consume us, especially something like anxiety, which is something that a lot of us are touched by in this particular culture and time in history. I don't know if you guys know this or not. I've been reading a few articles over my vacation. That's one of the ways that I rest, is I read some stuff. You know, I listened to a martyrdom book about Richard Wurmbrand while I was on vacation. So that was really edifying to my soul. Very difficult. But then I read a bunch of articles about different things, and I'm just banking stuff away, find things very interesting. And one of the articles, several of the articles that I read, were about the anxiety epidemic in the Gen Z and millennial generations. These are the two most anxiety-ridden, depressed, down generations that we've seen in modern history. You just do a quick Google search and you'll see all these articles that come up. I wanted to give you one source here that I have a slide of that I found. Some 50% of 8th, 10th, and 12th graders are showing signs of clinical depression today in our culture, because they answered these three questions in this way: I can't do anything right. They don't enjoy their life. They don't believe their life is useful. And you can see by year how these go up in the social media movement. Look at this. As social media takes flight here in 15, 16, 17, 18, that's when depression goes up. That's when anxiety goes up. Very interesting to see what's going on in our culture. We're in one of the safest times in history, in Western history right now, one of the most prosperous times in Western history right now, despite what you see on the news and going on in our country. This is one of the most prosperous times, one of the most safest times in our country for all people, and yet despite society's relative safety and security that we're enjoying, anxiety is like through the roof. That's very interesting how they correlate with one another. If you think of another graph in your mind and you see the bell curve of relative security going up, so is relative anxiety. It's just paralleling that security graph all the way up. It's very odd. And if you think about how that works, Christians kind of understand why, what the secret is there. From our perspective, we understand it, because what it shows is we're putting our hope and trust in things that we inherently know we can't actually put our hope and trust in. And so it causes anxiety in us because we know it's never going to give us exactly what we want. And yet we keep hoping, we keep wondering, we get anxious about it because we want to grab onto it, we want to hold on to control, and we hope against all odds, really, that it's going to give us what we need, and it never will. And so we're afraid to lose that prosperity that we think we need. We're afraid to lose that security that we think we need, and so it makes us anxious. We're just waiting for it to all blow down like a house of cards, you know? And what we'll see in our text today is that Jesus deals with that very directly, and he says he has the answer. As a matter of fact, he's going to say he doesn't just have the answer. He's going to say he is the answer. That's what he's going to talk about here. He's going to say we all actually struggle with inner anxiety at some level, right? And he's going to say he's the answer. All you have to do is come to him and put his yoke on you, and he is the way that we overcome this anxiety in our lives. He says we're all yoked to something. We're all yoked to this guilt and this shame and this anxiety and this frustration, all these emotions that weigh us down. We're yoked to those things. And if we take that off and put on his yoke, it'll be easy because his burden is light. It's not even like it's a burden at all. It's satisfying. It's restful, right? Because what we see in all of these things, what do we say here all the time? We're restless when we have these kinds of emotions. We're yoked to restlessness, this guilt, this shame, this inner anxiety that we all feel. We're yoked to it like an ox is yoked to a cart or a plow. And Jesus says, if you take that yoke off and put my yoke on, I'll give you rest. That's what he's going to tell us here in our passage today. We can be set free from all of that stuff because his yoke is easy and his burden is light. He gives us rest. And so the main point for today, if you're taking notes, is this, and you can write it down. Jesus is the rest we need. He is the rest we need. It's pretty straightforward, but I don't want you to miss the language there. He doesn't just give us the rest that we need, although he will do that. But he is the rest that we need when we come to him. It doesn't just help us Sabbath better. He is the true fulfillment of the Sabbath. The very concept of the Sabbath he fulfills. He doesn't tell us to take a vacation so that we can rest. He is the vacation. He is the rest. He is the destination that we need to go to for rest. He's the rest that we need. You know, we were on vacation for 2 weeks, and it was beautiful, and thank you guys for giving us that. But it would not have been restful at all for me if I hadn't spent more time with Jesus. I tried to spend more time in the Word every day. I tried to spend more time in prayer every day. I tried to spend more time with the true source of rest so that in my resting, I could actually rest. Does that make sense? Now, I don't know if I did it perfectly or not, but I came back very well rested, and I believe it's because I found the rest that I needed for my soul, not just physical rest, although we need physical rest. But it's kind of a metaphor, it's an analogy for the rest that we, the deeper rest that we need. This is how the late pastor Tim Keller, you know, has influenced everything we do here, and I love to still talk about him and listen to his sermons. He says it like this: when you look at modern medical research, especially brain and sleep science, we've learned that we don't so much need a specific quantity of sleep as much as we do a quality of sleep, right? We need a certain quality. We need that deep sleep, that REM, the rapid eye movement sleep. We have to go into that deep sleep or else we're not going to get much physical rest at all. Doesn't matter how much rest we get. Doesn't matter how long we sleep. If it's not deep and it's not that kind of deep rest that we need in our body to rejuvenate our body and to restore our cells and to restore our mind, then it's not going to be very good rest at all. We've got to have that deeper sleep. And so today in our text, we'll see Jesus say, in effect, that he is that deeper kind of sleep for our soul that we need. He offers the deep rest that we need because he is the rest that we need. All we have to do is come to him, be known by him, and know him personally. So we have to go to him and nothing else. And that's the hard thing. When I say nothing else, the Bible, when it tells us nothing else, it means nothing else. That's the hard thing here. So as we go through this, you start thinking about, am I putting my rest in Jesus and nothing else? Or am I putting my rest in Jesus and something else? Or am I just putting my rest in something else, period? That's the thing that we ought to be thinking about as we go through this text together. So let's go ahead and read it here in chapter 11, starting in verse 25. And then we'll discuss a few things as we go through. But this is what it says, chapter 11, verse 25. At the same time, Jesus said, I praise you, Father. So he's praying here, Lord of heaven and earth, because you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and revealed them to infants. That's very interesting because it's kind of like the 1 Corinthians chapter 1 passage where he talks about how God's made the wisdom of the world look like foolishness and he's made the foolish look wise. That's what this reminds me of. That's what Jesus is saying. right? He's hidden these things from those who look wise, and he's revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, because this was your good pleasure, all things have been entrusted to me by my Father. No one knows the Son except the Father, and no one knows the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son desires to reveal him. And this is how he reveals him to people. This is what it says, verse 28. Come to me, all of you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, because I am lowly and humble in heart, and you'll find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Man, we'll stop there for a second. That is just so beautiful, right? Some of us just need to hear that this morning. Those are the words of Jesus to us. We just need to hear that rest. But we also need to see that Jesus is self-identifying as God in this. Did you notice that? Because sometimes you'll hear people like Jehovah's Witnesses or something like that say, show me where Jesus says that he's God. You can't, because he never does. And you're like, no, that's just foolishness. That's just pure foolishness. They just don't know the Bible. They don't know Jesus' teachings. Because when he quotes Isaiah, we've seen him quote Isaiah for the last 3 weeks. When he quotes Isaiah, or he does something like call himself the Son of Man from Daniel, or he does something like this where he references Jeremiah the prophet here, he's applying that to himself as though he is God. He's saying this word of God that you heard from the Old Testament prophets, where God was speaking, I'm that. This is what he says in Jeremiah 6, for example, where he references this here. He says, this is what the Lord says. Stop at the crossroads and look around. Ask for the old godly way and walk in it. Travel its path and you'll find rest for your souls. He's identifying himself as that pathway, right? Later, we'll read in John that he's the way, the truth, and the life. Nobody goes to the Father except through him. And he's saying, if you walk my way, if you come to me, I will be that rest for your souls. Walk in my ways, he says. Put my yoke upon you. Follow me, and I'll give you the rest for your soul. He's claiming to be God there. I don't know how much more clear he could be. Matthew, our author, clearly wants to demonstrate that for us here. And he's displaying his divine authority and his ability to give us this rest. And he does it through stories, as we've seen him doing these miracles over the course of our series so far. And so in chapter 12, he gives us another one. He writes this interaction here. Chapter 12, verse 1, at that time, Jesus passed through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry and began to pick and eat some heads of grain. And so he has this interaction with the Pharisees, because when the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, see, your disciples are doing what is not lawful to do on the Sabbath. They're still confused about who Jesus is here. And he said to them, haven't you read what David did when he and those who were with him were hungry? How he entered the house of God and they ate the bread of the presence, which is not lawful for him or for those with him to eat, but only for the priests? Or haven't you read the law in the law that on the Sabbath days, the priests in the temple violate the Sabbath and are innocent? I tell you that something greater than the temple is here. If you'd known what this means, I desire mercy and not sacrifice, you would not have condemned the innocent. For the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. Oh my. Man, if that's not clear enough that he's saying, I am God, I'm the Lord of the Sabbath, I am the Son of Man. What he's doing here is he's paralleling himself with David. He's saying he's like King David, right? He's putting himself on equal footing with King David, of whom he's a descendant. He is that, right? But then he's putting himself on equal footing with the priests in the temple. He's saying, I'm like the priest, I'm the highest priest. But he's not just doing that. He's saying, I am the temple. I am the very place where God dwells with humanity. Something greater than the temple is here. He's talking about himself. If that's not divinity, I don't know what is, right? Jesus is saying he's God. He is the Lord over rest. He's the Lord over the Sabbath. He's referencing Genesis chapter 2 as well. But Jesus is the rest that we need because he is God with us. Verse 9, moving on from there, he entered their synagogue. And there he saw a man who had a shriveled hand. And in order to accuse him, they asked him, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? They knew Jesus wanted to do something good for somebody. They knew Jesus' character. And they're like, hey, let's try to trick him here. Let's try to trap him. And he replied to them, who among you, if he had a sheep that fell into a pit on the Sabbath, wouldn't take hold of it and lift it out? A person is worth far more than a sheep, so it is lawful to do what is good on the Sabbath. Then he told the man, stretch out your hand. So he stretched it out, and it was restored as good as the other. But the Pharisees went out and plotted against him how they might kill him. So we're starting to see who the Pharisees are versus who Jesus is. And as we discussed a few weeks ago, the Pharisees and religious leaders, they were threatened by Jesus' authority, right? He's saying he's God, and he's showing miracles into how he's doing it. He's applying the scriptures to himself, and they still can't believe it. They don't want to follow Jesus. They want to kill him. They didn't want to come to him. They wanted to do away with him. But Jesus clearly shows his authority, even over the very concept of the Sabbath rest. And he proves it with a miracle here, like we've seen him do in so many of these stories in Matthew. You know, I've talked about the Sabbath before. I don't want to go too deep into the theology of that. But, you know, it's a reference to Genesis chapter 2. And if you remember reading the seven-day creation event, you get to the sixth day, and there's a beginning and there's an end, and then you get to the seventh day where God sees what he's created and he rests. Well, there's a beginning to that day, but there's no end. There's no end to that rest. That rest is meant to continue on until the day that Jesus returns and restores all things and actually brings us into the rest with him. That's what Jesus is saying he's Lord over here. He's making a reference all the way back to creation and saying, I am that rest. I am the fulfillment of that rest that you have been waiting for your whole life. I am he. That's what he's saying here. But I don't want to miss what Matthew is saying exegetically here, because Matthew's writing this for us so that we can understand some things about who Jesus is. And one of the things that he's trying to point out here is the difference between the Pharisees' burden of the law, so doing what's right and wrong, versus Jesus' freedom from the law, not being able to do anything to make yourself right with God. So he's trying to help us understand this here. And he's pointing out this juxtaposition between the two positions. So it's not the law that saves you, in other words, he's saying. It's not following the law that saves you and doing what's right and doing what's wrong, not doing what's right and doing all that stuff. That's not it. It's following Jesus. It's knowing him. That's what saves you. He is the fulfillment of the law itself. He's the Lord over the Sabbath. You know, back in verse 28, chapter 11, verse 28, when he talked to the weary and the burdened, he wasn't just speaking generically to people who were anxious and tired, although maybe it includes that, but he was specifically talking about this kind of burden, the burden under the law, the burden of having to be perfect and do what's right and wrong. It's a burden to know what's right and wrong, to try to do it, knowing that you can't do it completely. That's a burden that the Pharisees are placing over top of everyone, including themselves, maybe, or hypocritically not. They get a free pass somehow, even though they're not perfect, but everybody else is worse than them. There's this guilt, a guilt-oriented religion of doing better and trying harder, where if you don't do the right things and you do the wrong things, you're in trouble, man. You can't be made right with God. You got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. You got to try to do the good things so that God will love you and accept you into his people. So many people live their lives under that kind of guilt, and that is false. Christianity, it's a false gospel. It's religion. That's what it is. Jesus recognizes this as a burden and a yoke. He's in essence saying this, guilt is something you can never get away from. You're yoked to that guilt, and you'll never be able to get away from the guilt. You'll always have that inner anxiety, that restlessness that you just can't seem to put your finger on. No matter how much you do to make yourself happy, no matter how high you climb in the upper echelons of society, you'll never be able to find that rest, that satisfaction, that completeness that you're looking for. You're always going to have this. You're yoked to it. And you might try to say, maybe you're a humanist, or you know, maybe you're not a Christian here, you're not religious, and you would look in at this and say, nah, that's silly, man. I don't feel guilt. I'm free from all that, you know, mumbo jumbo. I don't have to believe in religion. I don't need rules and regulations. I'm free from it, man. Just throw it all off like me and be free, right? But Jesus is saying, friend, if that's you, you're not free. And you've deceived yourself if you think that you are. You don't have at times those moments where you feel bad about something that you've done? Really? You don't ever feel some regret in your life for something that you've done, a choice that you yourself have made? You don't have those moments where you feel kind of bad about yourself every once in a while, or the direction that your life is taking, you're not quite happy with that? You don't have choices where you've failed to meet the very standard that you might have created for yourself. You're like, man, I was trying to do this and I just couldn't do it, you know? You've even created your own standard. You can't meet that standard. See, we all have standards, whether we're religious or not. Even if we've created them or we've allowed God to speak those standards over us, doesn't matter. We create standards. And what Jesus is pointing out here is that we can't even follow the ones that we make up. You might make up standards and you can't attain to them. You can't even be perfect in the way that you define perfection. Don't fool yourself. When you say you don't feel guilty, I think you're just trying to deal with the guilt by denying it. I see this all the time, right? That's one way of coping with guilt, isn't it? Is to try to deny that you feel guilty or to point your finger at everybody else and make it feel like they're the ones that made you feel that way, right? It's not me. It's somebody placing this on me. Friend, that's self-denial. So I saw this all the time when I worked at the pregnancy center in Greensboro, all the time. We were out on the sidewalk at the abortion facility there in Greensboro, and we saw women going in and out. We saw volunteers helping women in and out of that facility. And man, some of those volunteers, they would get pretty nasty with us. And they would say things like, I shout my abortion from the rooftop. I'm happy about it. I don't feel bad at all. And you guys are the bigots. You're the ones making us feel shame. We feel this way because of you. And we weren't shaming anybody. We were simply there saying, hey, listen, abortion isn't your only option. If you don't want to do this, we're here for you. We'll help you out. Now you tell me who had a message of love and who had a message of hate. It's because they're denying the fact that they feel guilt and they're placing blame on other people. That's what we will all do that if we're backed into a corner and we don't deal with our guilt appropriately. That's what will happen. We'll deny that we feel guilty even when we do, but Jesus is gently telling us, listen, no matter who you are or what you've done, you can lay that guilt down and come to me and I will give you rest. That's what he's saying. It doesn't matter what you've done. I will take your guilt from you. That's Jesus' message to the world. If we just simply swallow our pride and turn from those things that are making us feel guilty and turn and look at Jesus instead, it's called repentance in the Bible. If we do that, he'll give us rest. That's all we have to do is come to him. That's what he says. But he does say that we have to come to him in a certain way. In verse 25, he says, we've got to come to him like an infant. So you can write that down if you're taking notes. Because that's how infants and children live. We got to go to Jesus like an infant. They're always aware of their need, right? They don't even try to feed themselves. They don't even try to change themselves. They just cry when they want something, don't they? That's what infants do. They just cry. They hope someone will step in and help them in their need. That's what Jesus is telling us we need to be like. And as they get older, you know, infants, they turn into toddlers. And even when toddlers start to say, no, I'll do it. You know, they start putting on their shirt and they get their, you know, stuff caught in there. Like Bo does this still. Gets caught in there. He's four, you know. You have to be like, okay, buddy, here, I'll help you. And he's like, yeah, I need your help. Right? Because he's a toddler. He understands. They know their need. That's what God tells us to come to him like. We have to go to Jesus like an infant with our need up front saying, I know that I need you. I know I have a need. That's how we have to come to him, with nothing but our need. So you can add that to the note, right? We're burdened. We're weary. We need rest. Jesus is talking about this deep restlessness that we feel when it comes to doing the right thing and trying to be perfect. And we just feel that we know that we can't do it. Deep down, we know we don't have what it takes. Yet we sense we ought to be able to do that. We sense we ought to be like that. And that's what gives us the guilt. We know that the standard is perfection. We just don't know how to get there. We can't do it on our own. That's why at work you feel restless sometimes. You know, when you're not satisfied with the job that you've done, you know you could do better. You get restless. Or even when you achieve what you've set out to achieve and you've gotten everything you want in your career and you're successful by the world standards, and that's why you still feel a little bit of restlessness because you're like, this is all there is? Work makes you restless if that's what you put your hope in. You feel this at home, you know, when you haven't been as good of a spouse as you know you should have been, or when you haven't been as good of a parent as you would like to be. I know moms feel this. I know mom guilt is a real thing, okay? I'm not a mom, obviously, but I have a mom in my home. It's my wife, and she feels this guilt a lot. And I know that other women do too, because you feel inadequate. There's this deep restlessness where you want to be perfect, but you're not. You can't be. You're restless. You might feel this at church too. You think coming to Jesus requires you to clean yourself up and to be a good person. You got to be a good person to go to church, right? You know, but in the back of your mind, there's this hidden sin that nobody else knows about. You're not willing to share with anybody because you're ashamed. Deep down, you know that you're not good enough. You're restless. And the beauty of what Jesus says to all of those and more is simply come to him. Just come to him. That's all we have to do. Like a baby, know your need and go to him. Because Jesus is the rest that we need. And notice he doesn't give theological arguments here. He doesn't give a philosophical treatise for all the principles that you need to follow. He doesn't do any of that. He just says, come to me and we'll talk. Come to me and I'll help you. Come to me and I'll give you rest. It's personal. It's relational. And again, an infant gets that, right? A child just reaches for mommy or daddy, right? When they're anxious or they're afraid, they just need someone to step in to their anxiety and their fear and to make it all better, to chase the fears away. And Jesus says, listen, if you come to me, I'll chase those anxieties and those fears away. If you put your hope in me and yoke yourself to me, I will help you in that. That's what Jesus offers in the gospel to us. That's not to say we check our intellect at the door or anything like that. No, we all have questions. We all have things that we wrestle with. But what it requires is that we go to Jesus first, primarily. Go to the man, Jesus, and see what he's done. Look at him. Look at his life. Look at his teachings. Look at all of those things. First, go to him. That's certainly what we ought to do. There's a place for having your questions answered. And if you need that, I'll sit down at coffee anytime and talk through any of that stuff. I've wrestled through it all, I promise you. But the thing is, Christianity is a relationship-oriented belief. That's what we have to get here. That's what Matthew is trying to point out to us in this gospel. That's what Jesus wants us to understand about himself. Christianity is a relationship-oriented belief. It's not a religion in the strict sense of the word where you have to do some good things or not do some bad things in order to know God. It's not even a philosophy in the strictest sense of that term. Because it's not just a set of principles that you have to believe in order to be a good person, although it includes both of those things, but it's first and foremost and primarily a relationship with the God of the universe who created you through his human embodied son, Jesus. It's to know and be known by him. It's to come to him. That's what Christianity is. That's what it means to be a Christian. Maybe you're here today and you've been in church all your life, but you haven't been treating it like a relationship. Maybe you try to follow principles. Maybe you try to be a good person and it's weighing you down. You're restless. And you can lay all that down today and you can go right to Jesus right now. He says, go to him. He'll take you in and he'll give you rest. But there's a second thing that he says to do in verse 29 that I want to make sure that I mention here before we close out our time. He says to take his yoke upon ourselves and learn from him. That means Jesus has to become our master. If you want to write that down, that's what it means. It's not just going to him, although it is going to him relationally, but it's going to him as what? As our authority, as the one who's Lord over our lives. See, back in those days, when somebody would go to a religious leader and follow them, they would say, they would use this term yoke. They would say they were yoking themselves to the rabbi so that they would follow him and learn from his teachings. Not an egg yoke, not Y-O-L-K, but Y-O-K-E, right? Like the yoke that goes on an animal, a beast of burden. Like you would hook an ox up to a plow with a yoke. It's that beam, the wooden beam that goes across with the loops on it, you know? And so he would say, or if you were following a rabbi, you would say, I'm yoking myself to this rabbi. I'm putting myself under his yoke and I'm learning from him. I'm going along with him in life and I'm learning. So Jesus says, take his yoke onto yourself. Yoke yourself to him. We're yoked to the anxieties of the world, the guilt, the shame, all the inner turmoil, the restlessness. We're yoked to all that. So lay all that aside and be yoked to Jesus instead. Follow him. Learn from him. His yoke is freedom. It's not a yoke of guilt or inadequacy. It's recognizing your inadequacy and your guilt and your need, and it's giving it to him and him giving you the freedom of forgiveness. That's what happens when we yoke ourselves to Jesus. He's saying we're inherently yoked to that guilt, but we can be yoked to him. We can trade yokes with him. He'll take all of our guilt and our shame onto himself, and he'll give us all of his freedom. Man, that's a beautiful picture of what it looks like to go from restless to restful, right? And I know what some of you guys still might be thinking. Maybe you're here and you're afraid of doing that. Maybe you've never taken the step to give Jesus all of yourself. Maybe you're holding a few things back in your life. There's just this one sin. You're like, man, I cannot let go of this. I don't want to let go of it. Maybe you're like, man, I just haven't taken the step over the line to follow Jesus because I know it's going to require me to give up all of the things that I love in life. Maybe you're just afraid of that. And I understand that. We're Americans here, right? We like to throw off all the authority over top of us. We like to be our own authority. We're Americans here, right? But listen, Jesus is saying, you're deceiving yourself if you think you can find freedom on your own. He's saying he's the only true source of this freedom that we're so longing for, even as Americans, right? He's the source of real freedom, not the American way. It's not a popular message, but that's Jesus' message. Jesus says, you can never be enough. The freedoms that you try to find can never be enough, and that's the problem. You feel that way at work, you get restless at work because you're never going to have good enough work. You're never going to have enough success. You feel that way as a parent because you're never going to be a good enough parent. You feel that way as a Christian or a religious person because you're never good enough. You can never be perfect. And that's why he says he's gentle and lowly in heart, because he knows you feel that guilt. He knows you put that on yourself. He knows that you're under that burden. And he says, listen, though, you come to me and I'll give you freedom. I'm gentle. I'm lowly. I'm meek. I'm humble. That's what he says here. In other words, we don't have to be afraid to go to him. He's not going to abuse us. His authority is good. It's not like the authority of the world that we're used to. It's not authority that's going to abuse. It's authority that's going to set free and to love and to care for. Jesus says that to us, and that'll give us rest. So the yoke that he offers isn't a yoke like the yoke of this world of guilt. It's a yoke of grace. And that's the thing about yoking yourself to something like your job or your family and your kids or something else in your life, your morality, whatever it is, anything you yoke yourself to, that thing, whatever it is, it'll either destroy you eventually or you'll destroy it. One of the two. So as soon as you do that and yoke yourself to something, that thing that you yoke yourself to will either destroy you, you'll destroy yourself, or you'll destroy the thing that you're yoked to. That's just how it works. Just think about how the yoke works. Like I said, it's the beam with the loops on it, and you yoke yourself. Just imagine you yoke yourself to an ox plowing a field. You put that ox in the yoke, and then you get on the other side. What do you think is going to happen to you with that ox, right? He's going to drag you along, or he's going to step on you and stomp on you, and he's going to destroy you. Or you're going to get so tired of him dragging you along that you're going to beat it into submission. You're going to destroy it. You see how, one way or the other, something, you're not equally yoked, right? It's going to destroy you, or you're going to destroy it. And that's what happens with families, for example, right? People idolize their children and how their children act, and so they take that on to themselves, and they end up destroying the very relationship that they find so much identity in. Or they do that in their job, right? And they yoke themselves to this success, and when the success, and they get there, and they've ostracized everyone around them. But they're there on top by themselves because it's destroyed them, or they've destroyed it. That's how it works every time we yoke ourselves to something. We will destroy it, or it will destroy us, one of the two. And Jesus says, come to me. Yoke yourself to me. I'm different. His yoke is easy. It's light. He's the better master. He is the rest that we need. He lived the perfect life that we should live in our place, right? He did that on our behalf. We're never good enough. We are guilty. He took that guilt onto himself. And he took that shame onto his shoulders. And he traded yokes with us. That's the beauty of the gospel. And he carries our burdens and our shame all the way to the cross of Calvary. And he died for that guilt that we have. And then he rose from the dead after that. And that power that he had over death means that we can now be set free from all those things that make us feel guilty and all those things that lead to destruction for us. See, Jesus was destroyed so that we wouldn't have to be, right? That's the gospel that we believe. He traded places with us. And when we come to him and take his yoke on ourselves, we can have his life and his freedom, both now and into eternity. That's the Christian message. So the question is, what burden or yoke do you need to lay down so that you can experience Jesus' rest today? What is the yoke that you are still holding on to? What is that for you? It's very convicting, even for Christians in the room, I feel like, because for me, I know that when I started feeling restless again, you know, at any time, we'll go through this up and down, ebbs and flows, right? Mountaintops and valleys in life. And when a Christian starts feeling restless, you know that you're not going to Jesus like an infant in those moments, right? you know you're not recognizing that he's the one that can actually give you rest. You're relying on your own wisdom, but it becomes foolishness for you. And that's a hard feeling to wrestle with, but listen, in those moments where you feel those emotions, the anxiety, the inner turmoil, the restlessness, what it can do is show you what's going on in your heart. It can wake you up to the fact that you need Jesus, and it can drive you back into his arms again because he's there. And he's saying, come to me, all who are weary, all who are heavy laden, I will give you rest. I am the rest you need. That's what he's telling us. And you might say, yeah, but you don't know what I've done. But Jesus still says, come to me. And you might say, but I've murdered in my heart, or I've murdered in the womb, or I've murdered out of passion. Maybe it's somebody on death row. Maybe you're watching this or listening to this, and you're in jail for something like that. Jesus still says, come to me. You might say, but I've kept this sin a secret, and nobody else knows it, and I can't get over it now. It's too late, and Jesus still says, come to me. You might say, yeah, but I'm worthless, or I'm useless, or I don't feel like my life has any meaning. I'm broken, and Jesus still says, come to me. See, that's Jesus' message about himself to this weary world. What do you need to lay down today so that you can let go of that burden and take on Jesus' yoke, which is freedom? Listen, there are a ton of ways that we could apply this today, right? Personally, socially, morally. And I hope you're starting to do that for yourself. I hope you're starting to apply this to your own life. But I want to apply this in particular to the issue of abortion today. As you might have noticed, we have a group out in the hallway. You saw the table on your way in called Love Life here. We do this about once a year where we adopt a week to just pray over this particular issue. And I thought it was very apropos for this week as we talked about Jesus, the gentle, the lowly, Jesus, the restful. Because that's often what this topic of abortion, it sows this discord among people, right? It's just so, oh man, it makes us restless. No matter what side of the aisle we find ourselves on, it's an issue that's divisive. And Jesus is saying we can come to him in this. And in Roanoke in particular, this is a major issue because Roanoke is the largest city in this entire region of the state and multiple states. And so we have two abortion facilities here in Roanoke, which is huge for the size that we are as a city. But they see people from all over the place, North Carolina, West Virginia, Kentucky, Tennessee, other parts of Virginia, obviously. And so this is a major issue here in Roanoke, not just for our citizens, but for people in the surrounding areas. And they come in hoping to have access to what they believe is maybe a personal right to abortion, or what I believe most of them see as a necessary evil, because in my experience at the Pregnancy Center in Greensboro, now I'm on the board here at the Blue Ridge Women's Center here, we see this all the time. It's something they feel like they have to do. It's their only choice that they have. They don't have a future if they don't do this. That's how most people perceive this in our experience. And what we need to say to them is that there's hope. There's rest for your soul. That's restlessness. But you can find rest if you just go to Jesus. And we're here to help. We're here for you. Anybody touched by abortion today needs this message of hope that we've heard, right? And listen, if this is you, and you hear this as a political issue, and you're like, man, I don't like this at all. Listen, I want to tell you, it's not a political issue for us as Christians. It's a moral issue for sure, but it's a human issue. It's a sin issue of rest and redemption. It's an issue that you need to grapple with and recognize as problematic. You might be feeling that guilt if you've had an abortion in your past, or maybe you've helped people or pushed people to an abortion, whatever it is for you. That guilt can be overcome through Jesus. That's the only way you're going to find rest. It's not through deceiving yourself into saying, I'm not guilty. I don't feel guilty. You're the one making me feel good. That's not it. I promise you, that's not going to give you rest. But coming to Jesus with your need will. And so if you're here and you still don't agree with that issue, or that, you know, you don't agree with our perspective here as a church, man, I'd love to sit down with you at coffee and talk through this. This is a major issue you need to wrestle with and come to a conclusion on, and be able to do it in a way that's not angry or bitter. You know, I mean, that's part of the problem is people won't sit down and talk in our culture today. I want to challenge you. If you disagree with our stance on this, then I would love to talk to you. I'll sit down with coffee all day. I'm not Jesus, but I'll try to be gentle and lowly in the conversation, okay? I promise I will. I'm not going to try to shame you or guilt you or anything like that. But we can have a real dialogue, and I would love to do that. If you come up to me after the service, we can talk. We can talk longer in coffee, whatever. I'm happy to do that. But if you've had an abortion here, I want you to know that we love you as a church. This is not something you have to hide. from us. It's not a deep secret sin that you have to keep inside. This is something you actually need to deal with and repent of and lay at Jesus' feet if you haven't done that yet, so that you can let him take that guilt from you, because he will. He'll give you rest. And hopefully what you've heard today is that Jesus is the rest that you need. You don't have to carry that burden anymore. I desperately want that for you if that's where you're at. Man, I know that you need that. And I hope you'll take it today, because he's just waiting for you with open arms. And that goes for you if you volunteered at the abortion facility, or you're a nurse or a doctor at the abortion facility and you've actually helped perform abortions. The same thing is true for you. You can have rest if you just go to Jesus. And one of the incredible things about what Jesus offers is for all who are weary, all who feel this restlessness, all who know their guilt and their need. See, all we need to come to Jesus is our need. And all we have to offer is nothing. It's a gift, even for the worst among us. That's how Paul says it, right? The Apostle Paul, who wrote half the New Testament, who helped lead countless numbers of people to Jesus and to follow them, he said that he was the worst of sinners. If we come to Jesus in that way ourselves, no matter who you are, what you've done, whether it's abortion or some other issue in your life, you can find rest for your soul. So here's what we're gonna do. I'm gonna pray, and then we're gonna respond in two ways today. We're gonna take communion like we normally do in just a minute. We're gonna practice resting in Jesus together before we leave today in that way. But before we do that, we're actually gonna hear from Jenna, our Love Life representative, because she's gonna tell us what we're gonna do this week. We've adopted a week to pray and to go try to make a difference through prayer in this way. We wanna be gentle and lowly in how we even approach the topic of abortion. And so we can consider how we're gonna respond in that way. But let me pray first, and then we'll enter in these times of response. God.